Pod Conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Brussel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for over 2.5 years shared with KLRB listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and other abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary on KLRB-FM is the most hard-hitting and comprehensive report of its kind in the country, relating as it does the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. Dialogue Conspiracy, a unique talk show, its most up-to-date, well-documented, no-nonsense political analysis going. And it goes over KLRB FM 102 on Monday afternoons at 5:15. This show was taped on October 1st, 1973.
Welcome to Dialogue Conspiracy, and this is our 120th week discussing political assassinations and conspiracies in the United States. The subject today is going to be hypnosis and mind control. The areas we'll cover are Chicago, Illinois, the Caribbean. Those are the two main areas, and we're going to talk about E. Howard Hunt, Mrs. Hunt, and hypnotists, and try to relate it to the attempted assassination of Jim Dunbar at KGO in San Francisco, an announcer on KGO radio station, and tell the story of a gunman that tried to kill Jim Dunbar, then went around the offices and killed an employee of that radio station named Ben Munson. The newspaper, our local newspaper, Monterey Herald, has a syndicated column by Maxine Cheshire with an article, The Strange Case of Mrs. Hunt. And much of the news that's coming out is in the social sections of the newspapers and in the obituary, the death notices. It's not on the front pages. The Strange Case of Mrs. Hunt this week was the explanation of the names of two doctors that were in her wallet at the time of her death. This is the wife of E. Howard Hunt, who died in Chicago, Illinois in December, and Mr. Hunt is a famous Watergate conspiracy. Mrs. Hunt had the name of Dr. Gary Morris with her at the time of her death, and she also had the name of Dr. Marvin Korngold, a neurologist. I mentioned these two men in my new article in The Realist, the psychiatrist, Dr. Morris, and the neurologist, Dr. Marvin Korngold. Dr. Morris vanished mysteriously, according to Maxine Cheshire, off of the Caribbean in the St. Lucia, the island of St. Lucia, recently. He and his wife disappeared. They were experienced boatmen. They were picnicking. No trace of them was found. Their boat was never located. The people were never located. Their children are alive, but they disappeared. This is the man whose address Mrs. Hunt had with her at the time of her death. And Dr. Marvin Korngold, the neurologist, said that he didn't remember Mrs. Hunt as a patient and explained that Dr. Morris was well known in his psychiatric work for the use of hypnosis, that one of the tools for his therapy was hypnotism. And this hypnosis comes through in the suggestion of it in the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the state of mind that Sirhan Sirhan has been on. And the subject today that we're going to go into is the possible use of hypnosis on Lawrence Kwong to achieve the effect of terror on radio announcers and controversial radio stations in this country that would continue to take the position that KGO is doing as they become more progressive in exposing some of the truths that are coming down in this country. It was September 27th on Thursday morning that a gentleman named Lawrence Kwong walked up to the window at KGO and stared at Jim Dunbar, the radio station is on the street, Golden Gate, and stared at him and pulled a gun and aimed it at his head. It was a bulletproof glass, and he took three shots. And Jim said right away, "Hey, will you call the cops? I just had a guy take a shot at me." And Jim Dunbar was in a state of shock, went off the air. Mr. Kwong went around to the office building inside where he ran into Ben Munson, an advertising account executive, and put five bullets into his body. And Mr. Munson died the next afternoon. Mr. Kwong then went outside to Hastings College of Law a few blocks down the street, where he was seen reloading his gun, and somebody was chasing after him from KGO, and they said, hey, don't go for him, he's reloading his gun, and he took bullets, four or five, and killed himself. The cover story, the news accounts are the usual kind of thing which you can accept or you can question, depending about how suspicious you are or how much you want to take at face value. It was described as a senseless shooting, a motiveless, meaningless kind of death for these people. Herb Cain referred to Mr. Kwong as a gun-slinging nut. If it were a conspiracy, I once did a show on the killing, what I thought was the killing of Robert Crown, who was jogging up in Sacramento, the assemblyman who had the deciding vote for the death penalty up there in the committee. And I'm going to throw out on the program today, because this whole incident just took place last Thursday, and this is Monday, my analysis of, there's just a few news articles out on the subject, but why I would be suspicious of this particular murder, of murder-suicide of Munson and Lawrence Kwong. In the first place, KGO is a very controversial radio station. It isn't a station that is as quiet as it was two or three years ago. You couldn't mention conspiracy on that program. Since Watergate, it's very open. I was up there and did 4 hours with Bob Trevor. I did another 3 hours or four with Roy Elwell. There was a time last year where they used commercials, and they had the dialogue conspiracy and Mae Brussel, and they had me talking about political assassinations last fall through the summer, and that was a commercial that they had for the station, advertising Dunbar Show and Jim Eason and other shows. And they talk conspiracy. They refer to my research all the time. They don't agree with everything, but they read it. Roy Elwell has read parts of The Realist on the air, and they all refer to the work down here, but not only my work. They bring up provocative questions, and there are very few stations, AM stations, around the United States that have this freedom. I know, because when I refer to KGO or KLRB, around the country, there are very few stations that you could get away with this kind of programming or talk about this kind of subject. The time of the shooting incident last Thursday, there were two guests on the station. One had just completed his interview, and the other one had just begun. The one that was talking was Jerome Waldie, and he was talking about the possible impeachment of Vice President Agnew. The one who was just talking at the time of the shooting was Stephen Wasserman of the National Lawyers Guild, talking about a people's lawsuit that there's a group set aside to, that want to set aside the 1972 elections, the people of the United States of America, plaintiff versus Richard Nixon, Spiro Agnew, John Ehrlichman, John Mitchell, Robert Haldeman, Patrick Gray, and Richard Kleindienst. They didn't get far into the show. The man standing outside looking in the window, Lawrence Kwong, was smiling and staggering and grinning at them, and they felt a little uneasy about him. But Representative Waldie was through, and the next speaker was on, Mr. Wasserman, and he hadn't got very far. Now, in my research on political assassinations, I have a very close friend who says to me, you make too many comparisons to Nazi Germany. You have no right to jump in on things and say these are possible conspiracies and make comparisons to what happened to Germany. But I feel that if we don't learn the lessons of history or read them or see if there's parallels, we're losing a lot of time. There's a new bill going before Congress to strip the president of his emergency powers. It was in the paper yesterday, on Sunday, because there is a fear that it could become like Nazi Germany. He has about 400 contingencies for emergency powers to take control, and they want to get this through in the next few weeks to strip them of these emergency powers. So Congress feels this can be like Nazi Germany, and the killing of Allende, the overthrowing of there, shows you what the corporations like ITT and the CIA can do when they want to do it. So the lessons of history, to stay consistent with the research, I can't put them aside when these little incidents happen. And in the book that I'm doing on Murderville, USA, in order to affect the cultural climate of a nation, I have deaths of judges, attorneys, hippies, hitchhikers, prisoners, political prisoners, actors, writers, people in all walks of life. When you have a revolution or a coup in a country, or you declare a fascist state, it doesn't happen overnight. And I do not have communications people, per se, radio announcers or radio stations, but I'm sure there comes a time, particularly with the AM stations, because they reach so many more people, that the scare or the intimidation or the attempt to assassinate is very effective. The effectiveness was proven because as soon as this shooting took place in San Francisco, I got a call immediately from Joe Redburn, KLATN in Salt Lake City. What's going on out in San Francisco? And they identify an announcer who has Mae Brussel on the show all the time, or Sherman Skolnick, or Bernard Fensterwald, or political researchers. He has to feel intimidated. Who's next? Who's safe? And they want to rule out of their mind, tell me you don't think it's a conspiracy what's happening out there. So my phone was ringing a lot all weekend, and people were concerned. And radio announcers have a good reason to be concerned with the scare tactic. Just this week, Ralph Nader went before the United Nations, and this is very important. He gave a speech before the United Nations that was printed in the Washington Post. I didn't see it in my papers out here out west. And the problem he posed was that we have to check into these multinationals that are taking over particular countries. And he suggested that people should investigate who is taking the land from various countries, what minerals and resources are being taken, what amount is being paid back into these countries. But the important thing that was mentioned before the United Nations was that these large corporations are changing the cultural, the word was the cultural climate of the country. They're transforming the social structure and the cultural climate as well. Not only economic, but what comes over the air. Well, I know that in Greece that was overthrown with the help of the CIA and the military junta was put in, they affected the choice of the radio stations, what is said, the intimidation or closing of radio stations, newspapers, dress codes. So before the United Nations, the subject came up, a Mr. Sunkel from Chile and Ralph Nader, we're talking about the problem of the not only economic but the social structure of these nations being overturned. And certainly the radio is a big part of the social structure. It's very educational. What's going on in San Francisco, KGO, around the clock is very educational. So with that in mind, and remembering the comparisons in Nazi Germany, the book that I have on Inspection for Disarmament, there's a section by E.J. Gumbrell, a professor from Heidelberg. And he did research from 1923 to 1932, and I refer to it in my articles in The Realist, and I'll always refer to it because he says that up until the time that Hitler became the Chancellor of the German Reich in 1932, there were approximately 400 political assassinations across the line of different kinds of people before they could take control of the country. But in order for people not to catch on, and there were things that had to be done to hide the person who was doing the crime. And I want to read those off and see how they relate to the evidence up in San Francisco of Lawrence Kwong or the John Kennedy assassination or the Watergate affair, because I think there's a link of the use of agents, of controlling them, and I'm going, in the time we have, to go into that evidence. What Mr. Gumbrell said in Nazi Germany was that the courts were able to conceal the guilty people, that the crimes that were committed, the guilty were never discovered. They were cleverly concealed. If a matter ever went to court, it was the innocent were left out free to continue the killing, and the guilty, the innocent were locked up, rather, and the guilty were let out free to reconstruct other crimes to keep the secret government getting more positions in power. And people were killed off along the line, and the murders were carefully concealed. And one of the ways they did it, that he gave an example, is issuing false papers and identities. Well, we see that with the aliases and the code names in the Watergate affair and in all the political assassinations, the use of these aliases. And they sealed off secret documents. Things were locked up so that you couldn't investigate crimes. In other words, you could effect cultural changes in Germany, but if you wanted to look up references of what happened to the crime, the papers were locked up. No proof of illegal activity was ever allowed to go to court. They tried to keep it from getting to court. And if witnesses were called, they concealed the truth. They weren't allowed to tell the truth. And one of the purposes of a lot of the murders that went on, not the major 400 political that crossed the social and political lines, but the in the neighborhood kind of murders that added to the 400 were public terrors to keep people terrorized and not knowing where terror was coming next. Well, the important thing is the secret documents and the use of selective witnesses so that the truth never can be told about the murders that affect the media or anything else that was coming across in Germany that would tell the truth about who was being killed until Hitler had total power. Then he took all the radios, all the newspapers and businesses, and he didn't have to lie anymore or conceal it. Well, getting back to the evidence of this Mr. Lawrence Wong, the newspaper had several pieces of information, not very much, but we'll go into those and relate them to a few other notes, which I have. First thing I always go into is the weapon. I mean, that is the most important thing in the John Kennedy assassination, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, or even an attempted political assassination, if it was one. I'm just going to use the ask the question, is it possible, or if it was, and present the evidence. The weapon in this particular affair was a Colt 22 caliber automatic, described by the police department as a puzzlement. They couldn't figure out. Now, why would the San Francisco police be so puzzled about this particular weapon? This is a silly man who walks up to a window and shoots and then kills himself. But the police have used the word puzzlement. They said it was not a stolen weapon. There was no evidence it was stolen. But so far as they know, there's no serial number for it on file anywhere. The Pacific Medical Center, where Mr. Kwong stayed, will not say how it was possible that he kept a gun in his possession at this particular hospital that he was at the time. It was it's a daycare place for outpatients. It isn't actually a hospital. It's called a community health center, but they would not say how it was possible that he had a weapon or when he had it or if they knew he had it. And the police say it was not stolen, and they can't find any file or any number in their puzzle. The second factor was a private detective. Mr. Kwong went to a private detective 6 months ago, and this is important because private detectives play a part in the Watergate, the Lasowitz, Caulfield, out of the New York City police squads, BOSS, the special tax squad, weaving out of the White House with Herbert Kalmbach, Nixon's attorney on limited money for these men. Thane Cesar was a private detective who you will see in the movie The Second Gun is allegedly the person who shot Robert Kennedy from the back of the head. This was a private detective. Well, Mr. Kwong also went to a private detective by the name of John Immerdorf 6 months ago, but he was concerned. And what he told them, he went to them because he said he was kidnapped. And he said that his explanation was that radicals kidnapped him, but always radicals are to blame. You know, if you have an assassination attempt, just like Liddy was going to blame radicals in Miami or the Watergate guy, he said he was kidnapped. The important question is whether or not he was kidnapped, not right now whether it was the radicals or the CIA. He said he was kidnapped. And what he told the detective, John Immendorf, was that a radio receiver was implanted in his stomach and that he got messages broadcast from Jim Dunbar and Jim Eason and that they were bothering him and that he was in agony. And he wanted to sabotage the station because he couldn't stop receiving the messages. He said he was kidnapped and radio receiver was implanted in his stomach. So we have this mysterious weapon and his visit to a detective. The third point to make is that he did, in fact, go on a trip. Now, I ask, was that kidnapping? Did he go of his own free will, or how did he go? He went to Hawaii in August of 62, a little while ago, and he said the purpose was to get away from that agonizing KGO. Well, I have a lot of agonizing experiences day to day, and I would love to go to Honolulu, but I would like to know what date Mr. Kwong went to Honolulu, and what day did he return from there, and what transportation did he take? Where did he stay? Was he in a hospital in Hawaii, or have surgical care, and who paid for the trip? Those things you'd have to rule out before you'd say there was no conspiracy in San Francisco, along with the gun and the detective. His family background was given as this. He has a mother who's in a mental hospital in Hong Kong. That doesn't tell you very much. There's a marvelous book out now. I want to tell everyone to buy it. It's called The Watergate File by three researchers, Bushell, Robbins, and Vitka. It's the size of Time magazine. It's an excellent book. If you turn to page 37 of that book, you see a photograph of Dita Beard with a hospital gown on her from the Rocky Mountain Hospital out in Colorado. And if you look at that picture, it's worth putting up on your mantle and saying, this is the face of America. She was once one of the most important women executives in the United States, And you look at that angry face with tubes coming out of her nose and around her head and neck, and Rocky Mountain Hospital, where her chic wardrobe for cocktail parties for the president of ITT, she used to attend, she's in her little bracelet with her hospital name, and you think of the mental condition that the media would have you think that Jim Garrison had, or Margaret Oswald, or Dear De Beard, or Martha Mitchell. So having Mama in Hong Kong doesn't tell us very much. Now, the father of Lawrence Kwong, they said, lives in this country. All the newspaper said was that Kwong, 25, came to this country from Hong Kong late in December of 1965, and he was naturalized through his father the following year. So under that category, I want to know how a person gets naturalized from Hong Kong in 1 year, which is almost impossible, what profession his father holds in the United States, what city the father lives in now, and why there's no identification of the family in the media. They're very absent, and they're trying to cover the story. The paper also said his brother, he was believed that he had a brother living somewhere on the peninsula. Lieutenant Ellis from the homicide said that he had a brother somewhere on the peninsula. The father and the brother would be interesting to know. They have information of something, because when he died, he had no identification on him of any kind. But some way they picked up that the brother and the father are in this country. Now, there's a law, like in Nazi Germany, that protects anybody from going into the hospital where he stayed or getting into the medical records of where he stayed or find out what happened to this gentleman. That law was passed in 1969. It's called the Lanterman-Petras Short Act, which prevents any person from getting the psychiatric study of a conspirator, any mental condition, or a hospital. This is a very convenient law passed in 1969. When the President of the United States wants to smear a person like Daniel Ellsberg and use it for electoral purposes, he can send a whole team with our tax money out to a psychiatric office and rob the files. But if we want to find out if there was a conspiracy or if this man was programmed to kill, they say, oh, no, you have to obey the law. It seems to me there's not going to be a trial. It seems to me with that man dead and having killed another man, that maybe the family would have enough insight to sue this particular place and find out the information on this man, if he was in fact an agent set out to kill and was programmed like he said he was. Now, they describe Mr. Kwong's illness at this particular hospital. His behavior or the way he moved around didn't indicate that he was dangerous to the psychiatrist. They wouldn't ascertain how any diagnosis came about him or what he was saying about the people at KGO. They gave out no information. The Pacific Medical Center for the West Side Community Health will give out no information at all, even though there's two deaths. They will not tell anything about Mr. Kwong, his prognosis or diagnosis. They will not tell how it was possible to keep a weapon at their place. They will not tell why, with a persistent phobia about Dunbar and Eason, they failed to notify people or give him the proper treatment. And they seemed unaware of the depth of the fixation. Previous to going into this Westside Community Center, Mr. Kwong was hospitalized at St. Mary's Hospital. He had 85 days there. It would be interesting to know how long he stayed at St. Mary's, what was the diagnosis, who paid for that, and was there surgery. The reason I'm leading up to this is we're going right into mind control and a book called Will We Control? In an article in the New York Times on a brain pacemaker that has been put into 10,000 persons by a doctor in Boston. You can buy them for $3,000. And it's an interesting article that just came out this week. But Mr. Wong also carried with him a death list. Now, this parallel comes into a book on the John Kennedy assassination in Chicago, written in the form of a novel. Mr. Kwong had a death list with the names of people at KGO. I think that the news media now is playing up the fact that the mental patients that are getting out are doing multiple murders. Remember the first of the year in January 1973, Ronald Reagan wanted an institute at UCLA to study the causes of violent behavior. And on the board of directors of that group are men that have done brain surgery, brain modification, and Nazi German scientists funded by CIA foundations. As a matter of fact, it was Senator Sam Ervin that said, hold up the money for this until we find out more about it. And that was from Washington. But in the state of the state message, Ronald Reagan wanted his institute to study the causes of violent behavior so that violence would be ended by 1975. They also wanted to build in California prisons for mental patients. This is one of the reasons to close mental patients. One would be in San Bernardino, and then the use of Vacaville and down in San Diego. So like Nazi Germany, you could exterminate or get rid of mental patients and not bother with the mental hospitals. And the use of certain piercings that allowed out of mental hospitals to do multiple murders, I think, should be investigated in comparisons to what happened in Germany to what happened now. 74 people have been killed by former mental patients. Edmund Kemper up in Santa Cruz, he was let out and he killed 8. After killing his grandmother and grandfather, he was released, killed his mother and a friend and others. One, Corona, so the story goes, was a former mental patient, and he was accused of killing 25 migrant workers. I think the evidence indicates Juan Corona not only didn't kill the 25, but they could plant the evidence on him because he was a former mental patient 10 years ago, and that would go with the story of the way the political offices want to keep these people confined and then experiment on them. Herbert Mullen from Santa Cruz is supposedly the killer of 10 or more, maybe 14 or 15. I don't believe he killed that many at all, and certainly not those four kids that were in the 10. And the Santa Cruz story of the Oda family is wide open of all these murders. There's a lot of contrived situations going on in these mass murders that I've been following very closely. The one in Houston, Texas, where Dean Corll allegedly killed these 27 people. And there was a link because some of the bodies were going to be shipped to California, or more were shipped to California. Well, who was he shipping them to, and who would be blamed for the piling up of those bodies from Houston? Well, after I read this news account of Mr. Lawrence Kwong and how he went to the detective and said that he was controlled, and I read about the hospital that won't let out any information, and he said he was kidnapped, and you read about the trip to Hawaii because all the alleged assassins or patsies always have mobility to other countries, I went immediately to a book and an article, a series of articles which I have on the John Kennedy assassination called Were We Controlled? But also, as I mentioned before, in the Washington Post this last week, no, it was the New York Times, I'm sorry, New York Times, September the 22nd, 1973, if you want to look it up. It's an article called The Brain Pacemaker is Helping Some Handicaps. Now, always the public relations office lets you know that they are handicaps. It's a public service that they're doing this great research. But the articles, if you read very closely, are funded by the Navy and the Army and the Defense Department. And I really question the advantages of some of this surgery that they're doing. But this article goes into a Dr. Irving Cooper from St. Barnabas. He's in a Hartford Foundation. Now, I have to look that up in my file. I didn't have time before I came in to see if the Hartford Foundation is a CIA foundation, like the ones that are funding these other pieces of brain surgery. That Dr. Cooper's done 10,000 brain operations, and he's got a little gadget now. There's a diagram of it in the New York Times, and it's called the brain pacemaker technique. And they've got two sets of electrodes that are placed in front and rear surfaces of the cerebellum and two receivers the size of sour balls and implanted under the skin of the chest with wires or electrodes. And there's a little antenna, and he receives messages through the signals. And these little instruments are costing $3,000 in case you want to order one. But the New York Times had an article about that today. And then I looked up my early files because I've been doing research into the importation of Nazi scientists and brain control and brain surgery or European scientists. And I looked up my early articles going back to 1965 on Dr. Delgado at Yale University. His work is supported by the United States Health Service and the Office of Naval Research. Delgado's goal, this is an early article I had in my files, his greatest challenge, he said in quotes, is to substitute, at least in part, human intelligence for natural choice in man's design and man's highest quality or mental functions. He developed what he called a stymoceiver, which, when planted completely under the skin, simulates several areas of the brain at once. It transmits information to the brain, but it can take away your memory and take it away. He gave a lecture in 1965 at the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers in New York at the Hilton Hotel on developing battery less radio receivers small enough to be put inside the brain. He's given demonstrations in Spain where a bull comes charging in the bull ring and they touch a button and talk to the bull and he stops right on the spot. And he takes monkeys and that are nursing their mothers and they speak through a radio thing to the mother monkey and she throws the child away, throws it down, rejects it, and turns it away from her just on the use of the radio control. Delgado works with humans. This Dr. Cooper works mostly with humans back in Boston, not with animals. And also, Delgado works with the aerospace, too. He has signals, and the important thing is that they can control the sleep cycles of astronauts. There's a doctor down at UCLA that's working with the institute down there that said brain surgery isn't painful, and he's done a lot of work for the space program, NASA, and Dr. Delgado is useful. You see, his Office of Naval Research is funding him. And if they want the astronauts to stay awake at a certain time, they can. If they want them to sleep a certain time, they can. So his work is used in aerospace, and he wants to control the choices of human intelligence and man's design. And his little stymoceiver does it. And there's no wires outside, nothing attached. Well, I went into my library of research this morning when I was thinking about what this man said, going to the detective to say he was kidnapped, to say that he's controlled, that he's in agony, and he's receiving these messages. And I pulled out a research book that was written in 1967, that's shortly after the John Kennedy assassination, 4 years later, printed by University Books in Hyde Park, called Were We Controlled? The author is Lincoln Lawrence. And while I read it in 67, it's been a long time. I didn't know who Howard Hunt was or the Watergate team. And I was reading it with different eyes, and I was fairly new. That was just a few years of research I'd done at the time. Lincoln Lawrence was a man who worked with the Defense Department for 25 years, and he worked in newspaper work, magazine work, broadcast, and media. So he had a pretty high job at the time of the Kennedy assassination. He was in the Department of Defense. And he got information about a book in Chicago while he was in the Department of Defense on the killing of President Kennedy. And he was told, go to Chicago because somewhere is a black book. He described it as a black book about the assassination of John Kennedy. And he was told there was a novel somewhere floating around there and that this novel was about three men who were in on the killing of John Kennedy. And in the beginning of the book, he said, we were told there was in existence a report that named three men who concocted a diabolical plot to kill John Kennedy. He went out looking for a 58-page book in Chicago. Now, it's interesting that it was Chicago because that is the city where John Kennedy was supposed to be killed. There was a second man by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald. There was a Secret Service agent by the name of Abraham Bolden that came out from Chicago, lived in Chicago, and he went to the Warren Commission as soon as they were assembled and told them about a counterfeit operation that he uncovered in Chicago, and in the course of finding them, he found these men that were going to assassinate President Kennedy. It was supposed to take place November the 1st at the Army Air Force football game, and the plot was real. What happened to Bolden was that he was taken away and placed under house arrest when he gave this information to the officials in Washington. He was a college graduate, educated person. He had been in the Secret Service since 1960. He spent 6 years in prison from 1964, when the Warren Commission was working. He spent 6 years in prison, got out in 1970. That was his reward. He was arrested, he was denied counsel, and locked up for 6 years because he tried to explain about the plan to kill President Kennedy in Chicago. So out in Chicago is a book that Mr. Lawrence goes out to find, Lincoln Lawrence. It's funny, the author of Were We Controlled is Lincoln Lawrence, and the gentleman involved in San Francisco is Lawrence Kwong. But there's another comparison of names because it took him 3 years to locate that book on and off because he knew it existed, and in that it was a novel, a 58-page novel. And in the novel form, it described the control, the electronic control and surgical control of Lee Harvey Oswald and the counterpart of Jack Ruby and the manipulation of the seed, the grain, and the oil market on Wall Street the day that Kennedy was killed. Well, the novel he found was written by a man by David Warren, David M. Warren. I went right away to my file on the Watergate, on the alias file. I have over 700 files. I went to the alias file because it was described in the front, the blurb, as an explosive documentary novel. And he describes in Where We Control the difference between documentary and novel. But Edward L. Warren was the pen name of E. Howard Hunt during a lot of his espionage work for the White House. And Howard Hunt was in the CIA since the OSS days. And at the time, John Kennedy was killed, of course, and so was James McCord. And McCord and Hunt worked with the U-2 flight that Lee Harvey Oswald worked on. And I have that in my New Realist. I mentioned that briefly. But Edward J. Warren was a name that James McCord used as his alias. And Edward L. Warren was a name that Howard Hunt used as an alias also. And this novel, written by David M. Warren, that came out at the time of the Kennedy assassination, it was floating around Chicago, certainly should be investigated because we know that E. Howard Hunt was pushing all these novels under various aliases. And as time is allowed, I hope we all have time to read them and see if there's any similarities to the other assassinations. Well, at the opening of this novel, it describes an explosive documentary novel. The blurb on it says, it blows the lid off the secrecy of facts on the Kennedy assassination. There was a plot contrary to the Warren Commission. This is what the novel says. There were two directors of the plot and a third person and a key man. The story of the novel is about a marksman, other than Oswald, that fired a fatal shot, that Oswald was the dupe, and he was used. And the conclusion of the novel at the end is that a private investigator finds a diary. See, he's writing a diary, and it's a little black book that carries a detailed account of the plot to assassinate the president. Well, this same Lawrence Kwong had a little diary on him when he was found dead, evidently, or in his rooming house. Oh, another thing, he had this, Mr. Kwong in San Francisco had an apartment on Sacramento Street. I don't remember if I mentioned that. I don't know if that's a safe house or what money he earned to rent that or where he worked, how he occupied himself to have his own apartment on California Street or who he lived with or going to Honolulu. But getting back to this novel, the author, David Warren, wrote a blueprint. And it was called a rumor book because all the different theories on the assassination of John Kennedy, each one is a various rumor. And because Mr. Lawrence worked in the Defense Department, he knew there was a script for the killing of John Kennedy, and he went about looking for it. Now, what was the rumor about? What was the script about? It involved the manipulation of $500 million the day that John Kennedy was killed. And the book, Were We Controlled, is the facts of the John Kennedy assassination lined up against the evidence of the what was in the novel and how much did the novelist get into. In the remaining 10 minutes, I'll run down points that are in the book Where We Controlled and compare them to what he found in that novel in Chicago and see how close it comes to a lot of the situations somebody knew about the assassination of John Kennedy and wrote this up. And so what Mr. Lawrence was asking, did these things really happen? He keeps apologizing in the beginning. Don't think I'm crazy, but this is what really happened. Well, he begins in his book with what is called the Wall Street Rumor. And this can be backed up that on the day of the assassination of Kennedy, Friday afternoon, the stock market fell nothing like it since 1929. And the market, the people on Wall Street said it couldn't be accidental, that only the death of a president could cause such a drop, and it did drop, and a certain group of international criminals, he calls them, Germans from Argentine, intellectuals and scientists and so forth, he traced them to a group down in Argentine, could have profited, and he traced it to a particular corporation and group larger than ITT, a secret group that has communications under the ocean and all over many countries, 80 countries, a network of communications from Europe and major countries. And this particular group profited, and there's $500 million profit because they sold their thing at a top thing and the market was dropping. It involved what he called the scandal of, we're talking about the grain scandal now, the grain caper. It involved barley, corn, sorghum that was to be shipped to Austria for German and Austrian firms. It had to do with international control and the manipulation of $30 million in Swiss banks and dummy corporations and commodities, and there was a case in court about it. It had to do with crude oil and a corporation in New Jersey and Argentine, a complicated financial mess that took place the day that John Kennedy was killed but got lost in the media. But there were suits and investigations in California and New York, but it was such a complicated web that and nobody associated with the assassinations at the time. Now, war rate control goes into two factors. One's called RHIC, which is radio hypnotical intercerebral control, and the other is EDOM, which is the electronic dissolution of memory. And he uses the example of Jack Ruby totally losing his memory but having half recall, and that's why he could give certain clues about certain Nazis or Germans, because he feels at the time that he was being hypnotized or getting under control and getting ready to kill Lee Harvey Oswald, that he heard just enough before he went under, that he kept bringing it up and some of his memory was gone and some remained. It's interesting because in the book RFK Must Die, Robert Kaiser he can't figure out that every time they come to certain things about Sirhan's presence in the Ambassador Hotel, Sirhan baffled all the doctors by just shaking his head. He couldn't answer, he can't remember, and he just shakes his head in a very suspicious way, and that book brings up the subject. And that book was written after Were We Controlled, but it's on the same kind of response. And this man from the Defense Department, Mr. Lawrence, felt after reading the book that he got a hold of that it was very possible that there was this intercerebral control. He brings up the point that the United Nations, UNESCO, has an international brain research organization that they know about the control of memory and the dissolution of memory. And the book goes into the research of Delgado that I mentioned earlier in his brain experiments at Yale University. Now, he talks about the application of post-hypnotic suggestion that's triggered by a radio transmission, and an individual is placed under hypnosis, and with or without his knowledge, it's called narco-hypnosis, that he can be taught to respond, and his behavior can be played back, and these controls can work for an unlimited time. At the time of the investigation, Jack Ruby's trial, there were several psychiatrists that testified, and they couldn't figure out what was going in Jack Ruby's head. A Dr. Bromberg from New York said he was preset to attack, that there definitely was a block in his thinking. A Dr. Guttmeier from Baltimore said that Ruby's brain had been damaged, but there was no way to figure out how. And Mr. Lawrence says that this same application could figure. In the testimony of the trial, they said he shows a functional psychosis, but not organic. And the judge asked him to define. And he said a functional psychosis is a psychotic condition for which there is no known organic cause, and he does not have a brain damage. Dr. Schaefer testified at Ruby's trial that, and he's on the staff of Yale University in psychology, the same place that Delgado comes from. And he testified that Ruby lost the ability to control his own actions. He appears not in control of his body actions, as if they occur independently of his conscious will at times, that he was unable, according to these three doctors, to function the way his mind would have up to the time that he went down that ramp and the time when Oswald was killed by Jack Ruby. At the very same time that the assassination took place that week, there was a guest, or just previously, a Mr. Del Mar, who was a hypnotist at Ruby's nightclub. And a lot of persons looked for him after the assassination. He was never a witness before the Warren Commission. He was afraid of his life. He fled. And the subject was brought up, was a hypnotist in close contact with Ruby, because once they're hypnotized, you can put them under and then do these procedures that with or without their control. As I say, there's no problem. Ruby was a perfect group, picked by the group because he was a perfect type. And the book, Where We Can Control, keeps referring to the group. The novel, written by Mr. Warren, refers to the group that did this to these individuals. Well, at the Watergate hearings, you hear about the team or the company. There's very much going on about the company, like the Borgia stick. So the question is, did the group, based upon the novel, the little novel written by Mr. Warren, it seemed to fit in with the testimony of the witnesses. Now, Honeywell Incorporated admit that they're making instruments to penetrate man's mind, and there will be a distortion of our perception. This is spoken about. There was a professor, Anthony Deutsch, who spoke in Berkeley, California in 1965, who talked about the ability to juggle our senses of time, that we would be working with distortions of memory and be able to distort orientations, and radio waves, ultrasonic signals, would block memory, and people would no longer be aware of time. This was a speech given at University of California, Berkeley, 1965, and Honeywell has talked about penetrating man's mind. The novel called A Rumor, the novel about Lee Harvey Oswald in a little black book, the man that would have been the hero of this particular book, had a radio concealed in him with tiny electronic charges and signals, and he took direction. So the question raised by Mr. Lawrence was Oswald controlled by radio transmission? Was he programmed for criminal behavior? Well, Oswald was in a radio factory in the Soviet Union, and the book goes into his contacts with Germans, and von Morenschild, his best friend, his cousin, was an alleged German spy, Baron Meidel. De Morenschild was apprehended at Corpus Christi by the FBI for possibly being a German spy. Oswald applied to go to Switzerland, to Albert Schweitzer's school, to broaden his knowledge of German. So the book goes into the, there isn't time now, to the use of the Nazi German scientists to plant these electronic pieces of equipment into the body and control. It goes into Lee Harvey Oswald going to a hospital for 11 days and having a mastoid operation, which is impossible to take 11 days. And at the hospital, he proposes to Marina Oswald, the agent who's to become his wife. Well, time is running out. I can't go into all the information, but I think the situation of this man in San Francisco going to a detective, asking for help, saying he was kidnapped, having a trip, no basis of money, a mysterious weapon, the hospital keeping secrets, like in Nazi Germany, the weapon's a secret. I hope that people in San Francisco Bay Area will go into this a little further. I guess they won't unless I write it in an article where I lay all this information out piece by piece and then say, well, let's go into those files if they're not destroyed and see who Mr. Kwong was. But until I find out, I'll still put this under my catalog of suspicious murders. Okay, murder and attempted murder and suicide. Okay, I'll see you next week. Stay well. Goodbye.